Hello, is everybody in the class?
I got it.
Yeah, some people missing, yeah. I like this technology. I mean, I've never done this Skype thing with Mexico, never.
Yeah, it's
first time.
It's truly amazing. So you already did a Skype this morning. I see you just sent me a link.
Yeah, with Moscow. This was an interview with Russia Today.
Oh, okay.
And they wanted to talk about the war in Ukraine.
Okay.
And you know, the good thing for me is I don't have to travel to Moscow or to Mexico, and we can just talk to each other, which is
yes. Yeah,
that's the idea of peace research, you know, talk to each other and not bomb each other. It's much cleverer.
And to share and disseminate this information, which I think is very
important. Yes, and to debate, you know, to share ideas, to actually, I think life is interesting. It's a good time to be alive.
Yes, yes. And, well, speaking of the peace research, so we've read part of NATO's Secret Armies. And
okay.
We know you've published other material on oil, and I didn't know until recently that you founded the Swiss Institute for Peace and Energy Research. Can you very quickly tell us about your institute?
Okay, yes, I founded this institute here in Switzerland in 2011, so it's 4 years ago. Because I'm convinced that there's a link between energy on the one hand, oil, gas, nuclear energy, photovoltaics, wind, and on the other hand, the war in Iraq, for instance, the war in Afghanistan, the war in Libya. So there is a link between peace and energy. I'm very much convinced that this is an important area for research in the 21st century.
Okay. And then I guess let's go back to NATO Secret Army. And even before then, because I'm curious as an educator, and one of the reasons I do this is to get the students thinking. And I believe we need new generations of people like yourself, researchers like yourself. And so what was it that made you start thinking critically and begin questioning conventional narratives, you know, when you were a young student?
I'm now 42 years old, so it's quite some time ago when I was young. But I was 25, I think I was 25 years old, when I had to write a thesis. I was studying history at Basel University, and I had to write a paper for like 100 pages long paper, a really long paper. And I had half a year time to research it. It was the final thesis on the Cuban Missile Crisis. And then I went to the library and took all the books I could find on the topic. And then I found out that some authors said the Cuban Missile Crisis is the fault of the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union sent ships to Cuba with missiles, atomic missiles. I mean, how crazy can you be? And they sent these atomic weapons in the year 1962. And then I read these books and I thought, oh yeah, that's really crazy. The Soviets, they're mad people, and it's incredible. And then I read another book which said, no, the Cuban Missile Crisis, that's actually the Americans who are stupid, because they tried to overthrow the government of Fidel Castro, and they made an invasion, the Bay of Pigs invasion, in 1961. And, you know, only this invasion then later triggered the Soviets to send missiles to protect Fidel Castro. So really, it started not far away from Mexico, where my interest into international politics was really awakened. And then I thought, well, wait a moment, who's right? I mean, you have two different books. And that's, you know, 10 different books or websites today. And I think that's really the moment where everybody, every student can wake up when he has a research topic. And then he has two or three or four different opinions on the same topic. And for me, it was the Cuban Missile Crisis, but it can be oil, it can be 9/11, it can be paramilitaries, it can be the war in Ukraine, it can be NATO, it can be CIA torture, it can be many things, okay? But I advise all students in your class that they pick a topic, and when they look at it, that they realize that many books deal with the topic, but these books come to completely different conclusions. And that means for every student that he has to make up his mind. And that's the interesting thing about being a scientist.
And it's funny because we're learning this semester in one of my classes about World War II history. And the book that we're assigned is from an American publishing company. And in the book, it clearly, you know, I wanted to talk about false flag operations in a second, but in the book it says, and they know that the Japanese dressed up as Chinese and attacked themselves on the railroad.
Yes, did that.
And it's funny
the Manchuria incident. Yeah. You know, it's such a lousy trick. It really is a very lousy trick, but it works. I mean, you hit somebody and then say, you know, somebody else started it, and then, you know, it all starts. I mean, it's actually something that students know on a much, you know, much smaller level of violence. They know that games are being played in groups, in cities, in schools, in universities even. You know, these games are being played. But if you look at the games that are being played internationally with false flag terrorism, it really is shocking that these things still go on. But if you study it, then you can understand it. And you always have to keep in mind that it's only maybe 5 or 10% of the global population who have the chance to study these things. Everybody else is unemployed or working, or they just don't have access to this knowledge.
And the scary thing was in our book, it clearly described what the Japanese did, how Hitler did this, but it didn't. It never talked about the U.S. You know, the U.S. was great, and they totally admitted the U.S. false flag attacks, like Pearl Harbor, in a sense, or Lusitania. Yeah.
But, you know, that's something everybody has to wake up to. We have 200 states all over the world. And not all 200 states have the same power. I mean, take Costa Rica and take the U.S. They don't have the same power. Everybody can see it. And then, obviously, you have Russia, or you have Brazil, or you have China, you have the U.S., you have big countries, or Germany. And you ask yourself, who's the most powerful country on this planet today? And it clearly is the United States. So as a historian, I always explain my students, or in interviews or in lectures, I always say, U.S. is an empire. The only question is it a, you know, a benevolent empire, a good empire that tries to help everybody, or is it an empire that is just following its own interests? And if you look at how you actually define an empire, you have to look at, you know, how big is its economy. You take the gross domestic product, the GDP, and obviously the GDP of the US is the biggest. So you already have an indication that this is a powerful country. Secondly, you look, what's the most important currency of the world? And it's not the euro, it's not the yen either, it's the dollar, okay? So, okay, you say, okay, they also have the most important currency of the world. And then third, you ask yourself, well, who has the biggest amount of aircraft carriers? Everybody knows aircraft carriers. They're huge ships where you can land a fighter jet on. And it's the United States. They have 10 aircraft carriers. Like the British, I think, have only one, or the Russians have only one, or the Chinese have only one. They're very expensive. And then the fourth question you have to ask yourself is, who actually has the most military bases around the world? And you are all familiar with Guantanamo. That's an American military base in Cuba. But that's not the only one. They have a military base in Diego Garcia, which is in the Indian Ocean. They have Bagram Air Force Base in Afghanistan. They have Ramstein, which is in Germany. They have military bases in Italy. They have obviously military bases in Japan. I don't know what they have military bases in Mexico.
As far as I know, no, but I do know that they have a giant complex building in Mexico City where they spy on us from Mexico City. So.
Yeah, I mean, that's where you have to listen to Edward Snowden. He basically explained how that works with the spying, and I think he's very brave and courageous to come forward. He was only 29 years old, so never think that you can only make a difference when you're 60. Actually, when you're 60, it's too late. But what I wanted to say is you have to understand that the U.S. is an empire, and this force of the empire stretches even into books, because you started with this question, why in books do we only learn about false flag operations of the Germans or the Japanese and not about false flag operations of the U.S.? Because if the book is printed in the United States, or written by a professor in the United States, it will say the United States is sometimes engaging in wars, yes, but only to help the people. They only do this for human rights. And this is something which you can either believe or you can't believe. I don't believe it, but you know, I don't know how you guys in Mexico think about it. I mean, there are many people in the US who don't believe it. I mean, I met Noam Chomsky once in Boston. He's a professor there. And he said, you know, it's all nonsense. It's not true. But, you know, an empire has to say, I'm here to help. And they can never say, I tried to get more power or I tried to get more money. People wouldn't like that.
No, I find many Mexicans, we totally agree with your worldview as opposed to Americans. Because, I mean, you know what's going on in Mexico. We're living through this insecurity, and the state-sponsored terror, you know, they killed 40 students last year.
Yeah, I've heard that. Totally shocking. Absolutely shocking.
So,
and I think that's why people in Mexico understand that violence is a problem. And, you know, that's here in Switzerland, it's different. People sometimes think, oh, you know, everything is fine. I have my job. My kids can go to school. And I tell them, according to a new study in Iraq, 1 million people have died since 2003. That's a study of international physicians against the prevention of nuclear war. So these are doctors, okay, medics. That's the guys you go to when your knee is broken or when you can't breathe well, okay? I trust these guys. These are doctors. And they say 1 million people died in Iraq since 2003. And obviously that's a war which the American Empire started. And I don't understand why you can't read that in the newspapers. You know, you just can't, because many people who write newspapers, they don't want to lose their jobs. And so they only write nice things about the U.S.
That was my next point before asking about NATO's secret armies, where why don't many people follow examples? For example, your example, do you know personally or of many people who dare to pursue the truth into such deep waters? You said you were afraid of losing your job. I'm not sure. I met once the French geopolitics instructor. I can't pronounce his name very well. Aymeric Chaprade, who's now a member of the National Party in France. And I know he published a book on geopolitics discussing 9/11. And he was blacklisted, I believe, at French universities. I mean, now he's doing okay, but I mean, do you know, are many people speaking out? They're afraid to lose their jobs?
Not many people speak out. Many people, you know, tell me things when we're offline, okay? When we're not in front of a camera, when we're not on a podium in a university room, when we're not, like at 12 o'clock at night when everybody has had three glasses of wine. That's when people say, you know, I don't think that we've been told the truth about the Iraq war. These are all lies, and Bush and Cheney, they're actually war criminals, and I'm quite disgusted about CIA torture, and I don't like the National Security Agency spying on my mails. That's when they say it. But during the day, they say, okay, you know, the U.S. democracy is trying to stabilize European security by sending troops to Germany and reinforce NATO security. So you basically have two different sorts of languages. And one sort of language is the language which says, you know, the empire is good. We have no problem with the empire. And the other form of language is when you're just in your small group and you then really share what you really think. And I think that's wrong. I think, you know, as researchers, we should always put forward our analysis. If we make an analysis, I mean, I made an analysis on about 9/11, and I came to the conclusion that this third building, World Trade Center 7, that it collapsed, but it was not hit by a plane. And still today, I'm totally convinced that this building was not hit by a plane, but it collapsed. So I was then working at the ETH, that is the Center for Security Studies, in Zurich. That's another city here in Switzerland. And, you know, I said, we must research this. And it is a huge problem, a huge problem. Everybody was scared. Some people said, no, we should research this. And I said, why not? And they said, because Switzerland will get into trouble. And I said, no, I don't think so. And then I said, well, you will get into trouble.
And that's what
People are very scared all over the globe. And so if I have one message for everybody in the room, don't be scared. Don't be scared.
Don't be scared. Well, someone's asking, I mean, how have you succeeded? And someone asked, have you gotten into trouble? I mean, well, I guess not, because you're still going strong.
Survive, right? Yeah, I got into trouble. Problem is, you know, I got my PhD in 2001. So before I got my PhD, I didn't say a word. Never did an interview, never had a public lecture. I just did my studies. I was reading my texts. I was just building my knowledge. And that's really what I advise everybody in the room. Build up your knowledge. I mean, you're really lucky you have a professor who opens up your mind. Because, you know, some people, they will just give you one sort of text and then you will basically be brainwashed. But you should read as many different books from as many different perspectives as possible. I'm not saying that you should believe me. What I'm saying is, if you read my book, very nice, read another one on NATO if you can. Have a debate with people who think the US is here to help, or have a debate with people who think the US empire is evil, or, you know, just go into the debate. That is science. Dig deep. And then ask to the question of the student. You will come at one point to the moment where you face your fear. Okay? Everybody has fear. I have fear. You have fear. Everybody has fear. And the fear comes in two forms. One form is that you think, I will be completely bankrupt. Okay? I will have no job and no money, and I will starve to death. Okay, that's a real fear. Every human being has this fear. And when I had this debate at ETH, they told me that I shouldn't research 9/11 and World Trade Center 7. And I said, yes, this is important. We should research this. There are many people who got killed in Iraq, and we have the surveillance states, and we have torture, and it's all based on this. And here in Switzerland, we are very fortunate. Okay, we're not being bombed. We have nobody killed. So if we don't do this peace research, I mean, who should do it? I mean, not people in Afghanistan, right? They can barely survive. So I think the people who are privileged, you are privileged, I am privileged, we should try to actually be courageous in our research. And then there is a trick. Once you face your fear, you find out, okay, it's economic scarce. You know, you think you will not have any money. That's a very, very big fear. And the second fear that comes around the corner, and I think it will be the same, is that everybody will laugh. You know, that will say you're a conspiracy theorist, or you're not, or you're stupid, or just a stupid girl, or that you're a boy who has no clue, and just that different names for saying you have no clue, you're stupid. And these two fears combined stop many, many people. And I felt these fears because then the Swiss newspaper popped. There was one journalist attacking me and saying I'm a conspiracy theorist. I'm not reading the newspaper. I'm going like, what? Why is he saying that? I'm a historian. I mean, why is he attacking me? And then you get angry and you think, oh, but that's not fair. But you can't reply because he prints the newspaper and you're just there to read it. And at that moment, you get very sad. Okay, so first you get angry, then you get sad. And what you then need is your friends. Okay, you just meet your wife or your mother or your father or your brother or your best two friends. And then you find out that only about 10 people matter. Only about 10, maybe it's even 5, or maybe it's only one person. You know, it depends. For every person, it's somebody else. But then you go to that person and say, see, I'm now researching whatever it is, and I have come to these conclusions. And then you present your conclusions. And then you ask your friend. And he doesn't have to be a historian or political scientist, okay? He can be your mother, who's never read a book about these topics at all. And you say, do you think it's wrong what I'm doing? Do you think I'm stupid? Do you think I should stop? And I personally did that with my wife. I told her, I said, okay, we have a little bit of trouble now because I'm being attacked. And they could fire me from university. And then she said, well, I mean, the question in the room is, are you sure that World Trade Center 7 exists and that it went down on 9/11? And I said, heck yeah, I'm sure. Okay. I would risk my job for something I haven't researched. And then she said, well, if you're sure, then you should not you know, you should not break. You should not say, oh, okay, it's not important what happened on 9/11. Or, you know, NATO secret armies didn't exist. Or, oh, no, CIA terrorism, no problem. You shouldn't change. What I'm saying is you should stay with your research. Never leave your research. I mean, you got to be very, very careful with your research. Don't get it wrong, right? If there is no building World Trade Center 7 and you're giving interviews about it, then your research is very sad, okay? You have to be very solid with your research. But once you've found data, check it again, and you're sure that World Trade Center 7 went down, then stay with it. And so my wife said, don't give up. And I said, well, okay, but then maybe I will stay a doctor. I will not become a professor. And then she said, yeah, but so what? And then I said, well, I thought, you think I'm a much cooler guy if I'm a professor instead of a doctor. And then she said, no, not at all. That's completely mistaken. I think you're a cool guy if you stay true, if you don't lie. That's what I like. And at that moment, I said, okay, but you know, there's a problem. We're paying 2,000 Swiss francs for our rent here. So that's $2,000 a month for the rent. And if I don't have my job anymore, we can't pay the rent and we have to move out. And then she said, I'm not scared of that. Okay. Then we move out. We'll find something cheaper. And then I said, you're serious? And she said, yes. And after that moment, and that's really interesting, after that moment, I felt completely relaxed, okay? I did not have this, oh, it's very dangerous feeling anymore. I had this feeling of, okay, my wife, and I asked a good friend of mine as well, a good friend of mine said, hey, these are very important topics. I mean, continue your research into NATO secret armies. And don't give up. And then suddenly you find that your family and your friends are the most important. And when they help you, you can do incredible things. Maybe you don't get rich, but they will help you to overcome your fear. You can't do it alone. You can try. But
you need something. I totally agree. And you found a good wife to support you like that. It's amazing. Yeah,
very lucky.
And as well, you mentioned 9/11. I've shown the clip about World Trade Center 7, and we've even spoken to one of the architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth. So,
oh, your students know World Trade Center 7. They all know it.
Yeah, and again, I told you in Mexico that you show this 15-minute clip to Mexican students, and 99-100% of the people in Mexico, it's obvious. But in to Americans, you know, we have a few American students or people in America, you're fighting, you know, against the tide. So here,
I think it's very, I mean, that's the thing with the U.S. U.S. is very close to you. I mean, I was in New York. I love the city. I was in Seattle. I love the city. I was in Florida. You know, I went to all these, I was watching alligators and I was at Miami Beach. And I mean, I want to take these things apart. America as a country is a wonderful country, okay? I really liked LA and I have friends in the US, okay? I know American scientists who do great work. And the American population, there are 300 million. I think 280 million are just very good, decent people. But they have, I'm sorry to say, no clue about what their country has done during the last 70 years. They have no clue. I tell them, do you know that you armed both Iraq and Iran during the war from 1980 to 1988? Then they go like, oh, no, I didn't know that. That's probably to help. And I say, to help? If you arm both sides, they were killing each other. And then I say, do you actually know that the CIA set up the Mujahideen in Afghanistan and therefore actually created Al-Qaeda? And they go, oh, no, I don't think that's true. I mean, I've never seen it on Fox News or on CNN. And I go like, they're completely brainwashed, completely brainwashed. So I understand that when they are confronted with World Trade Center 7, which is the most difficult, okay, that's the most difficult. Iran-Iraq or Iran-Contra affair or Operation Gladio or even Operation Northwoods, that's easier. But if you start with World Trade Center 7, that's probably a shock to everybody in the U.S. But I think there's people in the U.S. are also waking up because they are very moral. They don't want to kill people just for profit. They don't want that.
And it's a bit of cognitive dissonance, I suppose. But talking about NATO, you know, we don't have to go over the basic premise. You've spoken about it ad nauseum on YouTube. Anyone can see what Operation Gladio was. But I guess, you know, when I talk about this at the university in European politics, and the students really loved your reading, because I give them, I flip between conventional readings and unconventional, and they loved your book. And some of them said they were going to go out and get it and read the whole thing. And my question is, after knowing about Gladio, you said the network was in 16 NATO countries. They did terrorist attacks. Correct me if I'm wrong. Some of the students that aren't in my class that are here now, they were asking, you know, what did they do? They went into supermarkets, right? And you detail where they shot shoppers, right? They blew up, they destroyed a school bus, school children, things like this, terrorist attacks, yeah?
I mean, it is, you know, when I started, I started with the Cuban Missile Crisis and worked my way through the data there. And then there was Noam Chomsky in Boston. I said, you know, did we have operations like that in Europe? Did we have, you know, a Bay of Pigs invasion or like the overthrow of the Arbenz government in Guatemala? Did we have something like that in Europe? Because many Europeans, I'm sorry to say, usually said, oh yeah, I know the CIA overthrew Allende in 1973 in Chile, but you know, that's just Latin America. And it's clear America, the US, you know, they do what they want, okay? They invade every country there and they arm the Contras, and who cares? Basically, it was a little bit like that. And I said, how can you say that? These are all wonderful people. I traveled there. I mean, how can you say that? And it's the same that they think today with Afghanistan. They say, oh, you know, it's just people in Afghanistan. So I said, I want to research something in Europe, because that's where it gets different. That's where people say, okay, no terrorism, please, in Europe. We don't want that. And then I said, okay, I researched the NATO secret armies. And as you said, the fact is NATO has had secret armies. The code word is Operation Gladio. They existed in all NATO countries during the Cold War, and they also existed in the neutral countries. So we had secret armies in Switzerland, P-26, and in Sweden. Sweden is not a NATO country. And in Austria. Austria is not a NATO country. And in Finland. Finland is not a NATO country. So what you actually have is something very, very sensitive. NATO had secret armies, and you can't actually have a secret army because actually parliament or professors or journalists or the public should be informed, okay? Because this is tax money. And if the tax money goes into the Secret Service and the Secret Service sets up a secret army, then, you know, then there's something wrong with the state. And what I can confirm is that CIA and MI6, so the American and the British Secret Service, were arming and training the secret armies. We had special operations forces, that's the Green Berets or the SAS, the Special Air Service from Great Britain. These are the guys that you know from Rambo movies. I'm not sure whether you know Rambo. That's what we watched when we were young. Maybe your students don't know Rambo anymore. That's the 80s.
Well, Rambo 4 came out not too long ago, so.
Oh, okay, so they still know that. Okay. But what I'm saying, these are the special forces, they're the most lethal military soldiers, and these guys train the secret armies in Europe. And now what we have, this is a fact. This is, you know, no question about it. On the other hand, we have these terrorist attacks. And in my book, very, very carefully, I try to show that the secret armies were linked to these terrorist attacks. But I can't, you know, prove it in every corner. I can say we have a report from the Italian Senate who says these terrorist attacks that we had in Italy, Bologna, Piazza Fontana, Betteano, many different terrorist attacks, these were carried out by right-wing terrorists. And these right-wing terrorists were protected by the CIA and NATO and members in the American establishment. And I have to say, I mean, maybe you're not aware of it, but U.S. terrorism in Europe still today is totally taboo. most people say it doesn't exist. And then I say, let's approach it. Let's approach it very carefully. Let's see. Do we have secret armies? The answer is yes. Then I'm saying, do we have terrorism? The answer is yes. That's undisputed. And the link, okay, the link between the secret armies and the terrorism, that's all still a hot topic. I say there are links. But you will find other researchers in Europe who say there's no links. And NATO will say, no, no links. Okay, we had secret armies, but no links to terrorism. These guys who did terrorism, they're just a crazy runaway agents where they're not under control. Okay. And so the question of U.S. terrorism in Europe is very delicate.
That was my next question. Well, first, telling us all of now, learning all about this and the bad things that NATO did, we're taught that NATO are the good guys, you know, the G.I. Joes of the world, and they're the good guys. But after learning this, you know, I'm like, for me, they're evil. I can't trust them because they've murdered people, and then I've lost complete faith in NATO. But yet at schools, we're taught that NATO is, like, you know, fantastic. So
forget it. I mean, look at what, always trust yourself. Don't trust anybody else. Trust yourself. And look what NATO has done, for instance, 2011 in Libya, okay? They bombed the country. To us in Switzerland, and maybe also to you in Mexico, they said, we have to do that because there's a very, very evil man. His name is Gaddafi, and we have to kill him or just, you know, regime change. We have to change, and then everything will be better. And now, if you look at Libya, what is happening there? What's happening there? The land is in total chaos. There are different groups, armed groups, who kill each other. I have a personal friend who went to Libya for the Red Cross. I mean, the Red Cross is based here in Geneva, and they send people to different places of the world to watch that, you know, there are no atrocities. And in Libya, obviously, they had the problem that some of these paramilitaries were raping women or were shooting children or were shooting elderly people. So the Red Cross had their people going there to monitor the rule of law. Okay, there's some sort of law even during war, because during war you're not allowed to rape children, for instance. It's forbidden even during war. You know, it's forbidden to shoot teenager girls. It's forbidden during war. It's not that in war everything is allowed. Okay. So this friend of mine, he went to Libya and he was shot. Okay, he's dead now. I mean, we were together at school and I thought, how can NATO bomb a country and then it's a total mess? And in the newspaper, I read, this was for freedom and democracy. I mean, if you believe it, then it's your problem, you know? And then take another country. Take Afghanistan, for instance. NATO started to bomb Afghanistan right after 9/11 in October 2001. They have now bombed the country for 14 years, okay? That's longer than World War II. 14 years, they have bombed the country. And we have more than 200,000 people killed in Afghanistan. So I don't believe that NATO is a force for peace. I mean, I always turn it around and think, what would we think if Afghanistan had bombed Switzerland for 14 years and we had 200,000 people dead in Switzerland, and somebody in Afghanistan writes in a newspaper article, that's just, you know, to promote peace. I mean, I can't believe it. I mean, I've become a critic of NATO. Yes, I think NATO has carried out too many things which are not right. And I think a new generation will wake up and will be much more critical of NATO.
Any students who have a question? Come on up, Juan, and real quick while he's coming up. Also, you touched on, I asked students the question, you know, we know about NATO. Wouldn't it be possible, and we see these terror attacks in Paris today, you know, recently in Paris and in Europe.
Yeah.
And for me, it's just like you said, it's logical. We know their networks exist. They did exactly these things, you know, the past 50 years. I mean, wouldn't it be likely that what we're seeing now is not every event, right?
Yeah.
But that a lot of them are probably these secret forces of our own government.
I mean, that is this nightmarish question which is out there, because when I, after I published NATO Secret Armies and False Flag Terrorism, after I published that book, many people said, well, that's very interesting, okay, but that, you know, the book goes until 1991, that's when the Cold War ends, and, you know, what's going on today? What's happening to me? What's happening to my children? And I've always said, well, you know, we must look very, very careful when we see a terrorist attack. We had terrorist attacks in Madrid, we had terrorist attacks in London, we had now terrorist attacks in Paris, we had terrorist attack in New York. Whenever you have a terrorist attack, be very careful, okay? Don't take the newspaper on the first day and believe everything it says, but, you know, do your own homework, do your research. If you think terrorism could be used, I'm saying could, be used to shock everybody and make people scared of other people which NATO wants to bomb. I'm putting it that way. In Paris, in January 2050, we had this terrorist attack, Charlie Hebdo. So basically, it's two guys, you know, armed guys who go into a newspaper room, shoot everybody, and then drive away with a car. That's the short story, 12 people killed. I mean, 12 people, if you compare that to the 220,000 people killed in Afghanistan or the 1 million people killed in Iraq, 12 people is not a lot. But remember, this is Europe. So these, and this is racism, but it's real racism, these 12 value much more than the 12 killed in Pakistan by US drones, okay? And so the Europeans look at it very carefully. And what I've seen is that the two killers who carried out the attacks, when they drive away, they change their car, the car in which they drive away, and one of these guys leaves his identity card in the car. Okay? Now, you can say bad luck. He just forgot his identity card. Possible. Maybe it was like that. But maybe that's a lie. And somebody put the identity card there to make it look like, you know, these were militant Muslims. And then afterwards, NATO can come and say, now we have to bomb Syria and we have to bomb Iraq and these people are dangerous. And if you don't believe it, you will have a terrorist attack in the city where you live. I mean, you can actually shock people with terrorism, that's for sure. And what I found out with my research on 9/11 is that it is very, very difficult. I mean, 9/11 is the biggest terrorist attack in history. So if you research anything in terrorism, take 9/11, 3,000 people killed. And that's the biggest terrorist attack. And when it's so difficult to even find the truth in the biggest attack, then you can understand that it is very difficult to research terrorism. But let me add one thing. Some people have come to me and said, okay, so you think that sometimes terrorism is manipulated? And I say, yes. And then they say, okay, and you think 1 million people died in Iraq? And I say, yes. And I say, okay, you think that the U.S. attacked Iraq without a mandate of the U.N. Security Council? And I said, yes, certainly, that's a fact. And then they say, how do you sleep at night? How can you walk in the street with a smile on your face? I mean, isn't the world a very sad place if your research is true? And then I say, wait. My research is not on human beings in general, okay? Most human beings, and I'm sure most in your class and most people you know, they don't want to kill anybody, nobody.
I hope.
They want to fall in love, okay? That's the most. They want to have a nice body. They want to make some money. They want to drink wine. They want to go on a vacation. Make the check, okay? Anybody out there who thinks, what I really want to do tomorrow is, you know, behead my neighbor. No. Most human beings don't want that. And that's why if you research these extreme violent things like Iraq war or 9/11, that's called extreme violence, okay? Keep in mind that only like 1 or 2 or maybe 3% of the world population is involved in these things. If you take 7 billion as the world population, that's 70 million people. You can say, okay, 70 million people is a lot. But no, 70 million, it's not your neighbor, it's not your brother, it's just a minority. We are the majority, 95, 96, 97. Percent of the world population don't want that,
and we let the others get away with it. We have a question here from our friend from Colombia.
Sure. Hello, hello, Mr. Ganser.
Hello, nice to meet you. What's your name?
Camilo.
Camilo. Hi, Camilo.
Hello. Yeah, first I would like to stress a comment on how difficult it is to speak about all of these topics, even with the academic community, because they've become almost a taboo or the kind of topics you do not mention because you're not supposed to, right?
That's it.
Now that you've mentioned Cuba and that you seem kind of interested in Cuba, I am also because I studied there for a season. And I don't know if you are aware of this, but in the last 2 days or yesterday, Obama has removed the country from the list of countries promoting terrorism. Because Cuba, Cuba used to be inside the terrorist watch list for the U.S. So my question is, do you consider Cuba to ever been a real threat to the U.S. in the last decades? Or do you see it as a rhetoric from the previous U.S. offices?
Well, I don't think that Cuba was a threat to the U.S. I think the U.S. was a threat to Cuba. I mean, look at the country. It's very, very small. It's like, you know, I'm always saying Switzerland is small and Cuba is small. And there's no way that Cuba could have attacked and conquered the U.S. No way. But if you look at it the other way around, the U.S. obviously could have attacked and conquered Cuba. And when I looked at the document from Operation Northwoods, these documents are now online available, and they say that to convince the American public that Fidel Castro and everybody in Cuba is evil, the American military, the Pentagon, suggested to blow up an American warship in Guantanamo Bay and then say the Cubans did it, or to explode a few bombs in Miami or even in Washington and blame it again on Fidel Castro, or blow up an airplane, a drone with nobody in it, and say, you know, these were students, American students flying to, I don't know, Latin America to help everybody there, and then blame it on Fidel Castro. So what I really think is the Pentagon is much more dangerous to Fidel Castro. I'm not saying that Fidel Castro, you know, has done everything right in his life. I mean, look at the Swiss. They don't have done everything right. We have had money from dictators in our banks, and every country has its dark side, which is not right. But I think what is important for peace research is really that we don't take over the rhetoric from the U.S. empire, which always says Cuba is evil and we are right. I don't think that the facts support this argument.
Okay, thanks. And
thank you.
I have two final questions. This one is kind of a big topic, but if you can just tell us really quickly, your book about oil is published in German, so I haven't been able to purchase it and read it. But I'm also a fan of the work of F. William Engdahl. I read his books. I'm sure you know him.
Yeah.
He proposes the other theory, I believe, the abiotic theory.
That's it, yeah.
Oil. What do you... Yeah. And I'm in between. I don't know. You know, Dmitry Mendeleev, the guy who created the periodic chart table, he also believed in that. And what's your thought of, is oil a natural renewable source? Or maybe it's natural, but it doesn't renew very quickly? Or is it a fossil fuel?
Yeah, let's talk about oil. I mean, oil is a very, very important resource today. Keep in mind that we need 90 million barrels of oil every day so that the world can function as it is. Oil age started in 1850, so that's 160 years ago. And in these 160 years, the world population went from 2 billion to 7 billion. That's very interesting, okay? During the oil age, the world population went up. During the First World War, we used every day just 1 million barrels every day. And in 1945, that's at the end of the Second World War, we had 6 million barrels every day. And today it's 90 million barrels. That's 45 supertankers. So that's really a lot. And obviously the question is there enough oil for the 21st century? Okay, so is there enough oil for you, students, and for your children? And that's one of the big, big questions. And some researchers say, no, in different parts of the world, oil production goes down. For instance, in the United Kingdom, that's here in Europe, oil production is falling, okay? The UK produced 3 million barrels in the year 2000, and they now only produce 1 million barrels. And to my mind, that's the case because of peak oil. They reached the maximum of production and production has fallen. And the same case is the case with Norway. Norwegian production has hit peak in the year 2000 and is now falling. The same is the case in Indonesia. Indonesia has reached the peak. Production is falling. Obviously, other countries like Saudi Arabia or Brazil can still, you know, produce more oil. But also in Mexico, there's a huge oil field which is called Cantarell, I think. Is that the right way to pronounce it? It's the Cantarell oil field. And research it. You know, it is producing less today than they produced 10 years ago. And so I don't think that Bill Engdahl, who's a very good researcher, okay, I really respect him. He's a courageous man, a smart man, no doubt. He's, I think, based in Germany. And I spoke to him over the phone about this question of whether it's finite or not, and we disagree. Okay? He thinks oil is endless, you know, it comes again out of the ground, and then these reservoirs fill themselves. That's the so-called abiotic theory. And I disagree. I think oil is a finite resource, and we're depleting oil reserves, and we're fighting oil wars, and we're heating up the climate. And so there you have an example of two researchers who are both very independent. I can myself. Very independent. Bill Engdahl is very independent, but we disagree.
Okay, and is your work going to be continued to be published in German, or how come there's not so much in English? Such as William Engdahl, a lot of his books are translated into different languages. Is that a personal decision, or you just haven't had the time or the...
The thing with the translation usually is not, it's not my decision. I mean, if you look at the NATO book, I wrote it in English originally. So I decided to make it available in English from the beginning. So I wrote my PhD in English, and it was the first time it was published in English. And then only later it was translated into Italian, into German, into French, into Spanish, into Russian, into Turkish, into Greek, some 10 languages, okay? But I didn't do these translations. I have no influence on them. It's basically somebody asking me from Greece or so, or from Turkey, saying, I read your book. I think it's very interesting. I think it should be published here in Turkey. I'm the publisher so-and-so, and then I say, okay, talk to my publisher in London, and you know, you have to buy the rights, and then you can publish it. And now this other book on oil, I wrote it in German, okay? So the original language there is German. And so far, no publisher in Spanish or in English has said they want to translate it. But if somebody comes, it's usually a publisher, you know, who has to ask, and if they say they want to publish it, I'm usually okay with it. I'm not against the books being translated, but I don't have the time, obviously, to do it myself.
Okay, and final question. So, you know, I'm always telling my students to be brave, to search for the truth, not to be
That's
afraid.
Good.
Not to be
That's
afraid
good.
Of speaking it. And what final words of wisdom do you have for the next generation?
The next generation is the future, so that's for sure. And I hope that you will always, always follow your heart, okay? If you want to be happy in your life, and I think everybody in the room wants to be happy, you have to use your heart and your mind together. That's a trick. And if you do your research and your mind finds out very interesting things, don't lose faith, okay? Don't start to say, oh, people will attack me, or I won't get this job, or I can't do that, so I shut up. I have friends who say, I shut up now, and when I'm 60, when I'm retired, I'm going to write a really critical book. This doesn't work. It doesn't work. If you postpone your integrity until you're 60, your life is over, and then it's too late. And so my message really is, be very, very good researchers, and be confident that many people across the globe are interested in peace, okay? We are the majority. People who are interested in peace are the majority. I'm saying we will always have conflicts. Everybody has conflicts every day with the neighbor, with other people in the traffic, with a father, with a friend, and then we yell at each other, and that's okay. Okay, conflicts are fine. Conflicts are very good. They help us to grow. They help us to, you know, to develop. Conflicts are fine, but we should not solve conflicts with violence. We should not shoot somebody because he has written a book we don't like. We shouldn't behead somebody because he has another religion. We shouldn't burn somebody because we disagree with him, and we shouldn't rape somebody because he doesn't want to have sex with us. I mean, it's always the same point. We should not use violence. And that's really the core message. I know this is no news, okay? I guess this is what you thought before, but I just wanted to tell you, you're right.
Okay, and well, thank you so much for taking the time with us. And here, you know, there's more students. You can't see them all. The class
very good.
Goes out.
And enjoy life. I mean, life is good. I mean, you probably think these guys who research false flag terrorism, they must be totally depressed and they don't trust any human being anymore. That's not true. Keep in mind, these extreme violent cases are from a minority, okay? And this minority exists, okay? Let's not get fooled that this is just something which doesn't exist. This minority exists, but ask around among your friends and you will find most of them, they want to fall in love. The guys want to buy a nice car, and it's all very normal things. They don't want to kill anybody. Really not.
Okay, and thanks a lot. And
good luck.
Have
a good night. Have a good night.
Best wishes.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.